Hey, welcome everyone to the PRL committee meeting. Before we begin, I'm going to read some announcements. So this meeting is being conducted in person at the Engineering Services Section boardroom. As a convenience to public, members of the public may also participate virtually by logging into the agency's room meeting. Any member of the public may listen to the meeting or make comments to the committee using the call-in number or Zoom webinar link. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public using either the call-in option or internet-based service, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. A reminder to staff who are presenting online, please mute all your devices until you are ready to speak. Make sure your cameras are on and you are unmuted. When you're done with your item, please remute and turn off your camera. Members of the public may comment as to items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency that are not on the agenda during item two. Members of the public wishing to comment on items covered in this agenda may do so at the time each item is considered. To participate in public comment from your computer, tablet, or smartphone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, click the raised hand feature in Zoom. You will be notified when it is your turn to speak. Please unmute when requested. To participate in public comment via phone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, dial star 9 to raise your hand. Phone participants will be called on by the last two digits of the phone number or by name. When it is your turn to speak, dial star 6 to unmute. So there are comment cards on the table outside. If you're attending in person as a member of the public, please complete and turn them to the to Ms. Gang to expedite the public comment section. Okay, so the procedure for the next meeting are as follows. I'll introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I'll ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion and questions from committee members. The committee then comes to a consensus to move an item to the board for consideration. Any PowerPoints shown at tonight's meeting will be posted to SCB Water website. Okay. So in attendance, we have myself, Director Bronstein, President Martin, Director Planbeck. Director R.J. Kelly is not attending today's meeting. All right, we're going to start off with the Pledge of Allegiance. And Director Planbeck, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Thank you. Thanks, Tim. Remember Hart, ready to begin.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, liberty, and justice for all.
Seated. Right. Are there any public comments right now?
None.
All right, we're going to move to item 3.1, a presentation by Jeff Bowman from VSA. Jeff, go ahead.
Thank you. It's good to see everybody tonight. After a month-long recess, Congress is back in session. They're on a bit of a staggered schedule. The House and Senate came back to D.C. at different times. They have one task that they have to complete before they break at the end of September to go home for the elections. And that task is to complete work on what we call the Continuing Resolution, or CR, to fund the government to prevent a federal shutdown. But like many things in Washington, D.C., success is rarely on a linear path. And so right now, both the House and Senate seem to be coalescing around a CR that will last through December the 16th. That'll get Congress through the election and the Thanksgiving holiday. But before that, they have to address several items within the construct of the continuing resolution. They have a White House supplemental funding request of $47 billion to fund activities like COVID, natural disasters, and the Ukraine, as well as a piece of permitting legislation from Senator Manchin from West Virginia that was part of a deal between him and Senator Schumer to get Senator Manchin's vote on the Inflation Reduction Act that I talked about on the last call. Right now, there's not a clear path forward for the CR, but anticipate them being able to reach an agreement sometime next week Again, the timing's unclear, but we know for sure it won't be done this week. So in terms of how we SCV Water fits in, so you have an earmark, you have community project funding for Bouquet Canyon to the United States Department of Agriculture in the House bills. And then on the Senate side, you have Arundo removal funding. They're really to initiate a study through the United States Army Corps of Engineers. Again, that's on the Senate side. We won't know the disposition of these earmarks or these project funding requests until December at the earliest. So what we've done, you know, at VSA in the last couple of weeks, so because Congress returned, the Senate came back last week, the House came back this week. So last week I wanted to ensure the Senate knew about the House funding request for Arundo removal. So I engaged the senator's staff last week to inform them of the Bouquet Canyon project. And then this week to ensure that the congressman knew about the senator's funding request for Arundo removal, I engaged the congressman's staff this week to inform them what the senators had done. Now, I did this to ensure that this engagement was at the front and center of the staff and didn't get buried in their inboxes in August, right after the bills had been made public. So, and then we have an engagement next week with some of the delegation. Next week, a few of us will be meeting face to face with some of the delegation. So we hope to continue to influence this process through the rest of this year until they get a final FY23 appropriations bill. And while we're doing these meetings, we'll also offer SCV Water's perspective on other issues, including PFAS. So touching on PFAS really quickly, in my write-up, I discussed the Superfund designation. The utility groups, the national trade associations are very active on this. You know, I'm talking about NACWA, AMWA, WEF. You know, they're all working together. And while I do think individual utilities acting alone probably won't be able to do much to influence this rulemaking process, we may want to consider filing comments to offer SCV Water's perspective on how a proposed rule could impact the utility and its customers. But again, this is going to need to be a bigger and more coordinated effort led by the National and Regional Trade Associations. Speaking of the Regional Trade Associations, I want to highlight the work that the Association of California Water Agencies, or AQUA, has done. Dave Reynolds and his team have done an excellent job on this issue, including requesting an extension of the public comment period beyond the November 6th deadline. This is a very complex issue, and it's going to need expertise and perspectives from outside of the Beltway to help craft an effective and a workable rule. We'll have multiple opportunities to weigh in this process. The administration, they have a goal of a final PFAS Superfund rule by August of 2023. And in terms of next steps for PFAS, the administration would like to carry out a proposed rulemaking under the Safe Drinking Water Act later this fall. So that concludes my verbal remarks for tonight. Thank you for letting me join, and happy to answer any questions you have for me.
Thank you, Jeff. Before we open up to the committee, are there any questions from the public?
There is none.
Okay. Dr. Plamba?
Do you foresee pushback on the Manchin bill?
There has been tremendous pushback on the Manchin bill, Director Plumbeck. To be clear, Senator Sanders of Vermont has suggested that if that is included on the continuing resolution, that he will oppose the continuing resolution. Last week, more than 72 House members sent a letter to the Speaker of the House saying if that was included in the continuing resolution, they too would vote against that bill. An additional 23 House members sent a letter. So we're up to 85 House members in opposition to the Manchin permitting bill. It's not going through what we call regular order. It's not going through a committee process. They did put out a summary of sort of the key principles of what they'd like to see in a permitting bill, but we haven't seen any legislative text yet. So there has been tremendous pushback. There's also those that are very much in favor of this. So there's not alignment throughout the Capitol. I'd say that, you know, the Senate Republicans are kind of in a position, you know, they're in three separate camps. There are those that don't want to do this just on principle for how the deal was struck for the Inflation Reduction Act vote. There are others that are in kind of a wait and see mode, wait to see what the legislative text looks like. And then there are others that after they saw the legislative summary or the legislative principles, that they didn't feel it went far enough. So again, there's not alignment in the Capitol to do something on permitting, but The Biden White House, they've suggested that they are supportive of this, of the Manchin bill, and there are others that have weighed in favor of this. So, again, it's one of the things that they'll just have to work out internal to their process, but it's going to be a wild couple of weeks.
If it doesn't pass for some reason, will that what will that do to the IRA? Inflation Reduction
Act. It will have no effect. So the Inflation Reduction Act is law, and so it will have, that will have no impact on IRA. It will have no impact on IIJA, the bipartisan infrastructure law. So right now it's holding up. It's one of the things that's holding up negotiations on the CR.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Dr. Bossi? I'm good right now. President Martin? Thanks for your report. I'm curious, on page one of your report, last paragraph states, landfills that become Superfund sites, the water utility that provided that PFAS resin or whatever byproduct could be treated as a polluter. You know, that water utility that provided that PFAS waste to that to the landfill could be treated as a polluter. I mean, how effective that regulation will be on us? Is this something that's going to be like a federal law, or is this going to be determined by the state or by county? What can we expect out of this?
So the federal rule will be federal. It will affect everything. And so if you Superfund, the statute is, the liability web is strict. It's several. It's retroactive, and it's designed as a cost. It's a cost recovery statute, essentially. But in sort of assigning blame or liability, if any entity touches that product or that material, they are liable for its cleanup. Now, in talking to someone in EPA, and I sent a slide deck to Steve just before this meeting. It appears that EPA is cognizant of the concerns of the utilities in terms of their responsibility, because while you didn't create the PFAS, you're responsible for treating it on both the wastewater side and the drinking water side. And so I think EPA is, they're going to try to craft a rule with the utilities in mind. The problem is, as I understand the statute, even if they are to, you know, promulgate a regulation that somehow exempts the utilities, I don't know how, when you get into the litigation phase under Superfund, if then all of a sudden you think you're out of the web, but litigation, they look at the statute and they say, well, they touch the material, they're liable, and it doesn't matter what the regulation said. So we're in for a bit of a bumpy ride here. Again, that landfill example was something that was shared with me from one of the utility groups. And in a previous life, I worked in the waste management sector, so I'm a little familiar with Superfund. I don't know if that directly answers your question, but that's kind of how I understand how Superfund works.
It does. Now, let's say we have a valid chain of custody agreement with our waste vendor, meaning we know that the particular resin, I'm talking about ion exchange resin that we have to offload from our treatment facilities. We have a chain of custody agreement with our vendor. They take on that resin, and the moment it hits the bottom of their truck, it belongs to them. So are we still responsible for anything that happens once it leaves our facility under that statute?
I believe under the law, yes, you are. You would be, at that point, you would be considered a transporter. And I believe the generators and transporters are still roped into the liability web.
Okay.
Again, a lot of this is going to get fought out in the courts. And this is going to be sort of like Waters of the United States, where you're going to see probably a decade or so of litigation over this. But I think once the federal government went down the path of a Superfund designation, I do think you will be pulled into that liability web.
All right, understood. What about remediation efforts to destroy PFAS completely? Have you spoken to your EPA contact about incinerators or EPA approved method of incinerating resin with PFAS in it?
I have not gone into that level of granularity with my contacts.
Okay. All right, because the latest white paper I have from EPA is dated from 2019, and nothing really has changed. And I'm just worried that it's my understanding that if we do send this waste to an approved incinerator, meaning that that vendor that does incinerate the resin follows EPA approved methods, and which don't exist at this moment, then the liability is no longer ours because it's that vendor that's incinerating the product, and then they will have to offload it somewhere as ash. So if they offload it somewhere at ash, take it to a landfill, are we still responsible as a water utility, even though it was not processed by us?
Based on my understanding, now you're asking me a legal question. I'm not a lawyer, but based on my understanding of the law, you are still liable.
And I think, Chair Orzowski, a lot of it has to deal like with how liable, right?
So, yeah.
And, you know, if the end person is not a good actor, you know, they're doing something illegal or disposing of it improperly, you know, in a court proceeding, that would all play out. But I think to Jeff's point, you know, we're touching it in there. And now that it has that designation, there is some potential liability that could be assigned to the agency, my understanding.
Okay.
I think that's why you've seen a lot of the organizations come out, you know, really heavy on this about, you know, working to try to work through an exemption for utilities. But I think Jeff's right. I think ultimately, you know, that all plays out in the courts and whether that holds up or doesn't hold up. But right now, there is not an exemption specified for water or wastewater utilities. There is one for airports, oddly enough. So that is something that has cracked open the door. So it's something that I know our associations are working really hard to try and at least get that designation. It probably would help. I think ultimately in that, you know, ultimate assignment of liability, whether it would prevent it, I agree with Jeff. I don't think we know that answer yet.
It's odd for airports too, because they are getting it from firefighting foam, is my understanding, and you can choose which foam to use. I hope that doesn't discourage them from choosing foam without PFAS.
Jeff, I sent you a copy of that white paper. It's only 2 pages long on incinerator use. And also,
okay. It
references also the EPA's PIT team on PFAS waste treatment. If you can just speak briefly with your EPA contact and see if there, I mean, I know we're focusing on response levels and levels within our drinking water, but this might be an issue, you know, downstream, you know, later in years on what happens to that ash if it gets dumped into a Superfund site. But yeah, I'll send it over to you and see if you can, if there's any movement from a particular department in EPA to create some kind of standard procedure for either incinerator use, or there's other methods of getting rid of PFAS too from waste. But if that's being kind of thought of.
Yeah, I'd be happy to take a look at the white paper, and I'd be more than happy to have further conversations with EPA. I plan on doing that as a matter of course, so I will add this to sort of my thinking when I speak to my contacts at both the Office of Water, and it used to be called the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, but I think they've changed it. But I've got contacts over there that I can put this on their radar screen.
Okay. Excellent. And also, we have a designate. There's a lot of people from Santa Cruz going to D.C., a congressional visit sponsored by KHTS. I know President Martin and Mr. Cole are attending. Do you plan on meeting up with Mr. Cole and President Martin when they're in D.C.?
We have plans to see each other on Monday morning, and we have a couple of delegation meetings scheduled to see the Senate staff and the staff of the congressmen. That morning, face-to-face meeting. So we'll have, you know, I provided Steve with sort of what I call a thematic document, things that we want to touch on. You know, the first thing we want to do is we want to thank them for the support, particularly for the project funding that we've gotten in the House for Bouquet Canyon. any Arundo removal funding in the Senate. You know, and I think it's also important for us to provide them with the utilities perspective on things like PFAS, not just with the Superfund issue, but other things surrounding with, you know, with PFAS and some of the other priorities that SCV Water has. It'll be nice to have Steve and President Martin in D.C. I know that you guys haven't been to D.C. in a while. So, you know, I plan on having a couple of meetings with these guys. And then I know they've got a packed agenda for the rest of the week. So
we do. I think my wife was telling me almost every day. She's proud of building that agenda for that trip. Do you have a copy of it? I'll be more than happy to send it to you.
I do have a copy of the agenda. I have to say it's one of the most robust agendas I've seen for a D.C. trip over 36, 48 hours. I'm impressed.
Yeah, indeed. Okay. Are there any comments, questions from directors? Okay, none. All right. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for your presentation. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to move on to our advocates from California. Mr. Ablani and Mr. Molina, go ahead.
Hi, good evening, and appreciate the opportunity. As mentioned at the beginning, we have one announcement, which is that Anna Lee Aiken will be helping us with the water side of the California Advocates, including Santa Clarita Valley. So I want to take this opportunity to introduce Anna Lee, or let her introduce herself. And appreciate the opportunity to continue to work with you all. And then we'll get into the bill. So go ahead, Anna Lee.
Hi, everyone. And thanks, Dennis. My name's Anna Lee Aiken. I have been at California Advocates for the last 4 years. Before that, I worked in the state assembly. As Dennis said, I'm just jumping into the water issue now as an advocate here. So I really look forward to meeting you all and working with you all and learning about all things Santa Clarita Valley water.
And Annalise, being pretty humble, she was an assembly fellow, one of the prestigious programs there for a year, and then obviously was hired by the assembly, and then also was a recent graduate from McGeorge School of Law. So we look forward to her joining the team and just wanted to get her on and introduce her. And you'll see her, you know, in the future, from time to time, she'll be working on these issues with us. So thank you. With that, we are in the middle of bill signing. And so, you know, the legislative session ended on August 31st. And I think as we discussed last time and Anthony gave the report, not only was it the end of the session for bills, but this year, kind of a unique situation with the budget, but unfortunately, I think it's going to be how it's going to be going in the future, is the budget trailer bills all came to fruition at this time, too. And Anthony will talk about those after we go through the individual bills. But so there's several bills that got through that we were working on, and the report lays that out. And again, I'm going to go through some of the highlights and go from there. So just the only bill that's been acted on that we were looking into, well, and following, and we were supporting, was 2449, which was the bill on that kind of put additional parameters and continued to allow electronic meetings and how you post on those. And that was the bill that was signed. And so that was a good thing. We supported that, and we're working closely with Aqua and some of the others. And CMUA to move that bill through and address it in a manner that would work for both the board, but also, or any board, public agency, but also the general public too, and balance the needs and interests of those. So that bill's been signed. The rest of them, some of the bills that we've had a lot of conversations about that are still pending the governor's work, but did make it to the governor, is SB 222, which is the ratepayer assistance bill. That is still pending on the governor's desk. And, the end, there were continuing to be amendments. But the one issue that was not addressed that was kind of the major concern is, where is the funding source coming from? I think some of the public agencies are concerned that that would be, you know, that they would require a local assessment that would then go to Sacramento, and then some of that may be sent back to areas of need. and districts with specific needs. And I think most public entities would go against that, and they want a state-identified source and general fund and or bonds and those kinds of areas that would fund a rate payer assistance program. So that's still the outstanding issue. But again, a lot of the issues were addressed and kind of made progress there. As we move into the other bill that kind of had action at the end and changed our opinion and our position was SB 1020. The state, we worked closely with the state water contractors, and the state water contractors and us met with the both the pro tem and Senator Laird on this bill several times. It was primarily an energy bill, but if you'll remember, the cost was going through the state. Department of Water Resources was going to have to purchase all the energy for the state to accelerate the zero carbon energy required by the bill. And there was about a $3 billion cost that had not been accounted for. So they put in some liability protections for the state water project and made sure that they would, that if there were cost overruns or any of those things, it would not go on to the backs of the state water project, even though they were, their professionals were securing that the contracts and the new water, energy requirements. So that bill, we got to neutral on that, was able to change our position because of that, that primarily liability protections, a few other amendments at the end, but worked with the state water board, Laird and Atkins. They appreciated the constructive work and got to a neutral on that bill. As we go through some of the other, bills that are kind of pending and our priority bills, you could see there was a couple other bills. You know, there was bills put on the inactive file, which essentially means they die because the end of the session. And so you'll see some notes on that. If a bill did not get passed, you know, the session ended. And so that is held as well. So maybe it just is on the floor and nobody addressed it, or maybe it didn't get enough votes. And then the other ones that voted through are the ones that are identified here that are used the term enrolled with the, governor's desk pending a signature or veto. The difference between enrolled and on the governor's desk means they just have not been sent from the legislative process yet to the governor. They're still in this, my partner called it purgatory the other day, kind of pending. They're getting reviewed. They can make sure that there's no chaptering issues and identify that, and then it goes on to the governor. So there's some that are actually on the governor's desk for action. The ones that are enrolled are still pending that kind of that suspense position right now, and they'll go within the next week or so. And then just to final that up, the governor has until September 30th to either sign bills, veto bills, or in California, they can let bills become law without a signature, but that's not likely to happen. It's been, decades since that actually occurred. So they pretty much act on every single bill, either a sign or a veto. And that's the process that we're in. And the other bill that brought some attention at the last meeting was 1157. That bill required the state DWR to reduce daily use, indoor water use for each per capita for each facility to be no more than 47 in 2025 and then 42 gallons per minute by 2030. And that bill, frankly, took an opposed position on it. It was held. We had been actively lobbying aggressively and with a coalition, and I go through some of the concerns with that bill. But essentially, it gave no credit for variances for any investments you may have done for desalinization or water reuse or water recycling. Previous legislation that required and administrative acts that required reductions in drought, always recognized that if you were building what Governor Brown's goal was, regional reliability. So they promoted kind of regional self-reliance and regional reliability and encouraged investments in water recycling, water reuse, and desalinization, brackish desal, things like that. This bill gives no credit for that. However, on the last day of session, the bill was stalled. It wasn't moving. It hadn't been brought up in 4 days. The governor's staff went to the Democrat caucus and said, "We really want this bill." So several of the holdouts from San Diego, I don't know, folks, San Diego has a $1 billion project that they've been working on and implementing for about a decade. South Orange County has all their wastewater gets pumped, gets cleaned and treated and then pumped back up and put into the basin. And several areas across the state have significant investments in these programs. Their legislators, met with the governor and met with administrators, and basically they were given assurances that they would have some type of message to the administrative agencies that they should consider a variance and give credit for those investments and future investments when they develop the regs and the rules to implement this bill. So with that, several legislators got up who had not supported the bill previously, spoke on it and said, "We have these assurances," which was kind of unusual, but it basically put the governor's feet to the fire since he had made those commitments. And so it's likely to be either, well, most likely an assigning message, is all indications, that 1157 will be signed, but it will be signed with some directive to give some credit for those investments that create regional reliability and create water and additional water so that those investments aren't really stranded assets, essentially. So that was a very controversial bill that was held there all the way through till the last day. And then about 11:30 that night, it passed. And so those are the assurances that were given. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Anthony, talk about the budget. So I'll kick it to Anthony Molina.
Hi, everybody. Good evening. And thank you for having me here today. I want to discuss the budget, as Dennis mentioned, in the way it actually rolled out, which was a very challenging year. It has been over the past 2 years since COVID kicked in. But really, I think we felt it most this year, given the timing with the new 72-hour rule, not new, but the 72-hour rule that's in place. As discussed on the previous meeting, when I provided an update, there were questions as to if we knew what was going to be rolled out and some of the priority budget bills around water and drought resilience, energy, et cetera, and the governor's final $21 billion climate package. And essentially, my answer was, we do not know, and nor do a lot of the legislators in the legislature. It was really a three-party deal between leadership, the assembly, the Senate, and the governor's office, along with Department of Finance, who finalized each deal and brought everything forward. That being said, Sunday night, I kid you not, roughly in between, I'd say, the hours of 5 p.m. and 8 p.m., the budget junior trailer bill dropped, as well as the natural resources bill finally dropped, which only gave it 72 hours. They had to be sat on file for 72 hours, and they could be brought up on the very final night of the legislative session. So as you see in your report, I mentioned that these were some of the final bills taken up to conclude the legislative year. And at that point, given the 72-hour rule, there's no ability to amend these bills. So what you see is in stone, it's what's in print, and it can't be changed unless there's cleanup next year in the budget bills. So that being said, for drought and water, I just want to highlight some of the bigger ticket items. For drought and water, they added an additional $788 million to what had already been allocated for the budget this year. Specifically, $110 million of those funds went to water recycling. We believe that is key given the current drought we're in. $67 million went to the Wildlife Conservation Board for land acquisition and habitat enhancement. We think this could potentially have value for Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency We're going to continue to look more into it, given some of the projects that may fit inside of the scope of that budget augmentation. And then, you know, briefly, just to touch as a state water contract member for energy, the highlight was $859 million total additional dollars were added to the budget. And specifically for Santa Clarita Valley Water District, as a state water contractor agency, $100 million is going to support the Oroville Pumps Station storage purposes. So with that, those were the final items in the budget that were tied up and wrapped up in that last week of legislative session. And once we're done with the report, I'm happy to answer any questions you guys may have. Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome, Annalie, to the team. Before we go, we'll open up to comments from directors. Any comments from the public? Questions?
There is none.
Okay. Directors? Ms. Plumbeck?
No, I have a question for Dennis, if he's still around. Did he go away quickly?
No, I'm here.
Okay, because I wanted to know, you mentioned that there was still a lot of opposition to 222. Well, how did it get passed if there was so much opposition? Because they didn't, you said that there's a lot of opposition still to not having a funding source. But it must be not coming from the legislators because they passed it, right?
Yeah, no, the opposition is generally the stakeholders. So like Aqua and several, you know, water entities, CMUA, those kinds of entities were opposed. Legislators voted on that. The governor got involved as well. So it's very likely that bill will be signed, would be my guess. Like I said, legislators weigh all the different stakeholders and figure out how they're going to develop that. And they, you know, advanced it. They could very well, in the future, in future budgets, for instance, so for a funding source, they could, in January 10's budget, governor's budget, he could put, I'll use the amount, $100 million. And then that would, the account's there, the rules are there, the regulatory agency has the authority, and then you just have to put the money in. But what I think some of those folks are concerned about, and there have been proposals in the past to bring money up to Sacramento from local, your ratepayers, and then send it back down. I think they would just like to make sure that there's a funding source that comes from the state down to the locals and the agencies that need it.
Mm-hmm. And the other question that I wanted to ask you is, as we look at cutting down residential water use and farming is looking at fallowing some crops, are we looking at alfalfa and people in foreign countries buying farmland and then growing alfalfa? Are they looking at that at all? Is anybody looking at that at all?
There's quite a bit of discussion. And a certain amount of that, if you don't have enough water within your jurisdiction, the district you're in, then it's very difficult to grow crops, high water crops like alfalfa, as you bring up. So some of that takes care of itself. And a lot of alfalfa has moved to Oregon or northern Nevada, some of the other places where there's more abundant, at least federal water and rain and regular water. So that has shifted anyways, and also there is some discussion about foreign, interesting to bring that up. Anthony and I have spent a lot of time this week and previously. There is actually a bill on the governor's desk having to do with foreign government ownership of farmland. I think it's SB 1084 by Hurtado. So there is conversations about that. You bring up some very good points that folks are looking at to say, you know, if we're, what does that mean when a foreign government could own, you know, farmland? So that was a conversation, actually became not more than a conversation, a bill, made it through the system and is on the governor's desk at this point.
Oh, well, that's good, because I think that's a big national security issue that I wonder if people thought about. And it seems, you know, I drive up and down the 5 occasionally because I have family in California. Still see a lot of alfalfa there. So I don't know what's going on with that. But I'm glad to hear that you think they're moving away. We need to grow food crops, not alfalfa.
Any other questions? President Martin.
Thank you, Chair Ozahosky. Hi, Dennis. Good to see you again.
Hi.
2449. Can you say again what the status on that is?
Yeah, that was signed.
That was signed. So that's
law. Yeah, that was signed by the governor, and it's law.
So it's evidently going to be law.
Yes.
And when will it become effective?
Let me kick that to Anthony, who worked on that for us. He did those. There's a whole section of bills that dealt with that issue. So, Anthony, can you address those?
Yes. Yeah, so this bill will become effective once AB 361 that was passed last year is in effect until January 1, 2024. Once that bill expires, this bill will kick in and will be in effect until 2028.
All right. So not until AB 361 expires.
Correct.
So we're going to have to worry about it for another year. So
that's correct.
What is that bill here? 1049?
Excuse me?
2449.
2449, yeah. So if our board doesn't invoke 361, then we still are attending in person or following the Brown Act as originally.
Oh, that's
that is correct. So, and then this bill, just to give you a little bit of more color and detail, this is just an option for local agencies utilizing the teleconferencing under specified circumstances. It doesn't even have to take place when there's a state of emergency. And then there's several parameters that they actually put in as guardrails to limit the scope of this bill, which is something we've discussed prior, but I'll give you just a couple bullet points that I was able to pull. A quorum of board members have to be present in person. The in-person location must be open to the public. The public must provide the option to participate via teleconference. Those members choosing the teleconference must make a request and receive approval from the governing board to do so. And then finally, teleconferencing members must participate through both audio and visual technology. So there are several guardrails if you do plan to use this in the future.
They just don't have to follow the posting requirements.
That's correct.
And so the conditions I saw were just cause. What is just cause? One of the exceptions apply if it's done for quote unquote just cause or for emergency circumstances.
Yes. So emergency circumstances, I believe what it captures in the bill, it's 20% of the meeting or three consecutive months a member can't be using this as I don't want to say an excuse, but a reason to not participate in person. But just cause emergency circumstances can be anything from illnesses to travel, not just emergency situations.
Okay. I guess we'll wait to see the see how it rolls out. We don't, it doesn't apply for another year, so.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay, again, thank you for your presentation and for your description. Again, welcome Annalie to the team. Regarding SB 1157, you provided a summary of this bill. Do you have a more detailed summary of SB 1157, Dennis, that you can maybe email us or me? I'm kind of really curious on what can we expect out of this moving forward, since it's most likely going to be signed by the governor.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can get that. We typically email to Steve and Kathy, and they distribute it to the appropriate board members. So we can do that. I spent a lot of time advocating on that bill and working with the staff and the legislators. So yeah, there's a lot of information on that.
Okay. Thank you for doing that. Yeah, my concern is definitely the public health aspect of it. Also like to piggyback on Derek the Plan Back. Thank you for addressing the foreign government ownership of some of these farmlands. I'll be definitely interested in more detail on SB 1084 on our next meetings. I think the committee would like to see that as well.
Yeah,
so we would like to see more detail on SB 1084. And Anthony, looking at page 11 on your report, California Advocates Activity Report, Certainly appreciate listing of all the things that you guys have been attending and participating in. I think you give the ratepayers a good understanding that you guys are participating and advocating on our behalf. So thank you for listing that and continue listing that.
You're very welcome.
All right. Any other questions or comments from directors? President Martin?
One more question related to 2449 actions, more related to 8361. We are still operating under a state of emergency, are we not? From the governor?
Yes.
Any word or any thought or anything going on with when he might lift the state of emergency?
So I can tell you, for instance, they're taking some of the rules down, you know, that they've put in place fairly regularly. So just earlier this week, they removed the requirement for teachers and school staff to be either vaccinated or tested every, I think it was week, or tested under a protocol. So they just removed that this week. I just happen to know that. My wife's a school board member. So, you know, we were just discussing that. They've also removed several requirements on certain, you know, entities on you know, those protocols, and they're loosening up the testing protocols and things that are. And I just, you know, happen to know that the COVID infection rates have gone down for 4 months straight. And so that's also justification for loosening some of those requirements. But no idea when he will actually remove the state of emergency at this point.
So the reason I ask is if state of emergency is lifted, then AB 361 doesn't work anymore. And if AB 361 expires before the end of, say, next year, like 2449 anticipates, does that mean 2449 then kicks into place? Is there language about that?
We can get that answered. I think that was the intent, that when 361 stops,
okay,
then 2449 takes its place.
Okay, whether it's the end of next year or whether it's when the state of emergency is lifted.
Yeah. Well, yes, that's, I believe, the intention, but we'll get that to Steve again as well. Okay. Get that question answered.
Mr. Cole, at this moment in time, our committee meetings and our board meetings, we meet the requirements of 2449. Is that right?
I think so. I haven't read the language in detail, so we'll need to do that. But I think, as Dennis just walked through, I think we're meeting that, probably exceeding it the way we're managing it right now.
Okay.
The real issue, just to bring this back up, and there is, folks, if you can't, if directors weren't able to be there for a variety of reasons, and some of it was during the emergency, and you were all teleconference, in theory, you were supposed to post, you know, and you're in your own house, the way the Brown Act, wherever a director was, you'd have to post there, and the general public had to be available. So there were some extreme examples. Somebody would be traveling. They might be in a hotel. You'd have to post on the front of the hotel. You'd have to post on the room. It was really significant. And it showed some of the challenges with doing that. So one of the issues they wanted to say is, look, if you can get a quorum live and there's a member who might have a health issue, you know, but we still want them to participate. How can we design a program to allow for that? And, you know, teleconference, how does it work? And how can you get, you know, the appropriate public participation and engagement without having them to open their house to have people come in and sit in their front room if that's where they are? And that's really that was really the conversation on how do you balance those two things and get maximum participation from members of a public body that may have extenuating circumstances, but balance also with public access and those kinds of things. So really, that was really the theory behind the bill, or the issue they were trying to address. Then it got down into details on how they would do that.
And if I may, very quickly, I want to correct the record, since we are recorded. I misspoke and I said January 1 of 2028. It's actually January 1 of 2026. I just want to make sure that we're all clear that that's as far as the bill extends out.
So it itself is a temporary measure.
Correct. It's temporary.
Oh. And from reading your summary, the legislative body can vote at the meeting where someone would like to attend remotely on whether they would be able to do so without posting if an emergency condition is presented and accepted by the legislative body.
That's correct.
But it can be right up to the beginning of the meeting.
I just hope we aren't considering people living in their summer houses to be emergency.
Well, I think he was saying that there were provisions about that.
Mr. Martin was asking what they were. Yeah, okay. How often? But I think it's like three meetings in a row, so that could be all summer. So it could be several weeks. I mean, we have two meetings in this.
Anyway, well, I guess we'll look at it when we see the full text of it, and I'll have our attorneys kind of advise us.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you for your reports, and we look forward to hearing from you next month. Thank you. Right. We're going to move on to item 3.3, presented by Mr. Brownlee from Pool and Shapery, our local advocate.
Good evening. Starting off with the Safe Clean Water Program and the WASC. In addition to the written report on the August meeting, I know there's an interest in not waiting for 30 days for the next report on what happened on September 1st. Since our meetings are now scheduled for the first Thursday of the month, so let me verbalize that, and we'll have that in writing at the next meeting, what happened on September 1st. The issue about having these meetings, right now we're still virtual, so the virtual video copies being made public, available to the public, and audio in the future if we meet in person ever again. County staff continues to be opposed to that on a regular basis. It must be requested. The committee felt very strongly that that was not appropriate, so we instructed our new chair to draft and send a letter. They did that. It was announced on September 1st. Interestingly, he asked whether or not staff had circulated the letter, and staff said they weren't going to circulate his letter until county supervisors, meaning their staff supervisors, have looked at it more. So we'll see whether there's a report at our October meeting on that issue. Our tree people, Peter Massey and his staff, continue to do a lot of work in the community and provided their updates to the various activities that they are reaching out to various community groups. Steve, are they doing anything? Have they reached out much to us at all? Or do you know, you and Kathy?
Yeah, I actually had a meeting with Peter, and I draw a blank on his counterpart's name.
Good.
I think it's Ashley. What?
That was Amanda.
Amanda Bigley, I think. Yes. So yeah, we they did reach out to me. That one was in specific regards to Bouquet Creek, and so I did provide them a couple of presentations that our agency has given on the topic. And yeah, I mean, I think they're doing a great job. They're engaging in a way that probably the community hasn't seen much of it before. So I'm happy with the way they're going about it.
I agree, and they're trying to also deal with the rural communities of Agua Dulce and Acton as well. I know they've also been trying to stay on top of the Arundo issue. So he seems to be doing a good job, and his reports are usually very interesting. We continue to have the discussion about a tour of the two projects in Stevenson Ranch that have been approved. The county is supposed to be setting up those opportunities for field trips. They want to make sure that there's not a majority of the committee at any one meeting. They think that's a Brown Act issue. I'm not quite sure why, since, you know, council members can do tours, planning commissioners can do tours. They're simply tours, they're not decision-making. But county staff seems to have that issue. We have gotten nothing since our last meeting about that schedule. And of course, that would be something that would have to be open to the public. Continue to try to get a better handle on those two projects and the benefits. There's one new project that was approved to go to scoring again. The process is the projects come to the WASC. We give it a blessing to go to the scoring committee with the county. Then it comes back with whether it meets the score, the expectation of this project, which is the Via Princesa Park and Regional BMP project at the old Metrolink site there in Canyon Country, will do well. And so we'll have more details on that hopefully at the next meeting and move that project forward. It is estimated to be a $20 million project that completed by June of 2025. Again, it's an infiltration project. I'm trying to see if there's a the information they provided. Again, this was just not a lot of details because it has to go to scoring first. So we'll have more information on the benefits, the amount of water, that sort of thing at our next meeting. But that's where we are with the WASC at this point in time. Did add in this report, Ventura County Board of Supervisors, as previously requested, indicated that there were some issues on water at their August 30th meeting dealing with water conservation with turf replacement and removal funding projects and the availability to try to get some grants. On September 6th, at the September 6th meeting, the Adobe transfer from the county to the city of Santa Clarita was approved. There ended up being no debate on it at all. And so that project is moving forward. And the LAFCO hearing was held yesterday morning on the annexation of both the existing Tesoro and the new project and the open space that's being granted to the city. Being annexed to the city of Santa Clarita, that was approved on the 14th, Wednesday, and the appeal hearing will be November the 9th, assuming there's not appeals, and I would expect there wouldn't be because it's a percentage of property owners that would then get to be recorded by the city no later than the end of November. City Council, there was a mistake in my report. I apologize. It was not July 23rd, the meeting was August 25th. I'm sure several of you caught that mistake. Again, that was the first meeting after their six-week hiatus, which they take every year. Everything was primarily on consent. Items of interest, again, which I documented. Additional work on the Tesoro annexation. A new architectural design firm, that's something the city's had for years. The city has its design standards. Always seems to be some disagreement on them, even with the standards. They've had an architectural consultant over the years. Majority of the council was having issues with the existing one, so they dropped them about a year and a half ago, and now they've gone out and gotten a new firm to basically review architectural submittals by any project applicants. Doing a feasibility study on a cultural center and museum. And then they did the Fourth Amendment to the lease with the water agency for Central Park. And that's basically my report.
Thank you, Hunt. Any questions from the public?
There's none.
Okay. Directors, any questions, comments?
Well, I mean, I was the one that brought up the time, the dates. So, I was thinking that maybe we could brainstorm a little bit on this because reading through the dates, first of all, I'm glad that it was a typo because I was like, why are we hearing about a July 23rd meeting, in mid-September? But so I'm glad that that was a typo. But also reading that there was an August 4th meeting, and then there was something on September 1st, and we're meeting mid-September, it just felt like we're always going to be a little bit behind. So I was wondering if there was a way to make sure that we stay a little bit more updated. I don't expect the city council meeting just happened last week. I mean, two days ago. So obviously, like, we're not going to hear about that in this meeting. That's definitely going to be next month. But all of our meetings are really mid-month. So I think, you know, anything that happens within a week, you know, maybe we could at least get an oral report or.
Well, let me suggest this, that usually, again, I'm just looking at my calendar, the next WASC meeting is October 6th. So there should be no problem with having a written report that includes that meeting. I think usually, and Steve can correct me if I'm wrong, Uni wants these by, you know, no later than the 10th. It really depends when the meeting's going to be for this committee, because she needs the time. But if, for example, I don't have to have the report done until the following Monday, which would be the 10th, then certainly we can include that in any Board of Supervisor meetings that would include the first week of the month. City Council is the 2nd and 4th, so that would not be able to be included in a written report if the deadline's about the 10th of every month.
That makes sense. I mean, I think if everybody's okay with that, I mean, or if you need to send in a supplemental report, is that okay? I don't like feeling like I'm a month behind on reporting.
That's understandable. I mean, if a report is due a particular day and there's another meeting that will not meet that deadline, I think it'll be okay to get something supplemental 2 days before our meeting. It can be sent to our committee secretary.
Okay. I will try to have the WASC meeting for sure in the written reports, because I think that's doable, being the first Thursday of the month. Anything else we can add to that, we will. And if there needs to be a supplemental, we'll do a supplemental.
Yeah, and what Chair Orzechowski, what I did talk to Mr. Brawley about after Director Monsey's input was, you know, just we have the ability to give it verbal. So it's really the question of whether you want it, you know, in that interim period when the report gets dropped and included in the packet, there's going to be a lag of a week or two. Certainly Mr. Brawley can give the report verbally.
Yeah.
It's whether you want it documented, you know, in a report. He can follow that verbal report up and post what he talked about in that one and the next one, but we've already talked about it. So that's another option.
I personally would appreciate it in writing. It could be bullet points. It doesn't have to be a meaty thing, but it could be something that I can follow through and write notes or know if I have questions about things ahead of time. You know, it just gives me a little bit more of a idea of what's going on versus, again, like, I don't want to be the troublemaker here, and I mean no offense to anybody, but I think that would be more helpful, just getting a supplemental something a little bit, you know, a day or two before, you know, whatever.
Again, just so it's clear, I think we can easily do the WASC meeting, which is the first Thursday of every month, and have that in writing, because I understand the importance of that. And also the Board of Supervisors meets every Tuesday. And so again, there would be probably the ability to, going into October, having the first, if not the second meeting available. So we'll make those efforts to do that in writing. And if there needs to be just verbal reports and anything after that, we'll do that in and either supplement it with a written report afterwards or just put it on the next month's report.
Thank you.
One thing I did forget, I apologize, is just to confirm that City Council filing has closed. There's 9 candidates. All 3 incumbents are running for re-election. This, again, will be the last at-large election for City Council. In 2 years, there will be 2 seats up that will be in districts. And these 3 seats will be in districts in 4 years. The district process is still not clear. Other than we know there has to be a public process next year, the plaintiffs has proposed that settled with the city, has proposed several districts that will certainly be considered in the public domain. And I'm sure the council's got some proposals as well. So that will be coming next year.
How long do you suppose that will span, this decision of districts?
I'm sorry, what was that, Peter?
In your perspective, how long do you think that the whole process will span? Will it span like a couple of months, 3 months, 4 months before a decision is made?
My understanding is that it's supposed to be done by next summer. So my expectation, it would be June, July. I do understand there's been discussions. Again, the plaintiff had a specific proposed district, which was as close as you can get to a minority-majority district in the Santa Clarita Valley. There's probably not a lot that can be done with that district boundaries if that's going to be a requirement of one of the districts. But again, there'll be a public process. We were told that it's going to start early next year. I think we'll know more after the city council election.
Well, it's going to have to follow the same make and model of our electoral divisions, right? Same rules apply.
Well, yes. I mean, you've got to have, you know, close to the same population. The real issue here is that one of them is going to have to deal with what the allegations were in the lawsuit, is that minority representation was underrepresented in a district, and therefore it's got to be a, I'm not sure it can be a majority. I'll be honest, I haven't looked at this in any detail, but just not sure you have the concentrations. And so that's going to be one of the challenges, but it's going to have to be a district that has significant minority representation.
Okay. All right. Piggyback on Director Bronstein's comments. It's my understanding that if anything of consequences of huge measure that you here in the city or in the county, you immediately report that to Mr. Cole and Mr. Cole's team for his awareness. Is that right?
Correct.
All right. Any other questions or comments? President Martin?
With regard to that Measure W committee, we have agency staff. Do we not speak on that committee?
Yeah, Dirk and I both sit on that committee.
Okay.
So one.
Yeah, and Hunt is a committee member as well. Okay. I sit on representing the Groundwater Sustainability Agency. Okay. Dirk's seat is for Santa Clarita Valley Water.
So we have a voice on projects that are proposed. Certainly. Make sure.
Yeah. Yes.
And our general manager, Matt Stone, is actually up at the next level on the scoring committee.
Okay.
So, yeah, we are, I would say, well represented. One of the challenges, and we saw it play out a couple meetings back, is that the way that the committee is structured, there is clearly a voting block that is in there, as was represented by one of the votes that we took a while back, where if the city and the county align, that vote will most likely move forward. They have the majority of the seats that are on the committee.
Well, and just to add, some of the county people can have up to 3 votes because that's the way it was set up. And so it gets skewed a little bit. I will say, I think we've been on the same side as the city most of the time. It is frustrating dealing with the staff. I mean, they're nice, but I mean, the bureaucracy of the county is unbelievable for any of you who've ever had to deal with it. And it is front and center in this committee on how they, for 3 months, we're canceling meetings without any representation to the committee as to whether we wanted to be canceled or not. And then this whole issue about how we get information to the public and the videos, it's just been quite frustrating. but it is the system we have. So.
Okay. Well, we have a voice at the table. Certainly. All right. Thank you, Hunt.
Thank you.
Have a good next month. All right, we're going to move to item number 4. Ms. Martin is not able to join us today, so Mr. Cole is going to present on her behalf communications manager activities and the following reports. So starting with section 4.1, social media quarterly report, Mr. Cole.
Yeah, I think I did talk to Kathy, Ms. Martin, before she left. She had a really, I think, exciting opportunity. She's going to the Barry Manilow concert with her husband. So I think that was on her bucket list too. So definitely didn't want to stand in the way of that. But Ms. Martin just wanted to make sure that the committee had the reports. There wasn't anything specific that she was looking to be called out, but I would be happy to answer any questions about them that you may have.
Okay, we do have, I believe, a mislabeling it. So there's no item for section 4.1. So it's just a verbal report. Any questions, comments from the public regarding social media quarterly reports?
I have something for Kathy, but it's not social media, so I don't know when this is the time to
come in. Okay, anyone on the public?
Yeah, it's public.
Okay.
We don't forget
the public.
Is it okay?
Pardon?
Is the public okay?
Yeah, no comments?
No, I had a question on SB 1254, but I guess it would have had been brought up in one of the
I think we're doing good on time. So go ahead and make a comment. So can you wait for a minute? Okay, please make a comment. Go ahead.
Now, I wanted to find out about this. The appointment. It is to, it was presented to the governor at 3 p.m. So I presumed it was already signed into law. And I was hoping somebody could really explain how it's going to be used.
Which, which bill are you referring to?
I'm sorry?
Which one are you referring to? Which number?
SB 1254.
Okay. Can you see the timer?
On page 64. Oh, thank you.
Continue with your comment. Do you want to know exactly what?
I just wondered where this was being used or how it could be used, because it seems to be a good idea after bringing somebody in to actually help the administration of a water company.
Well, we don't have our California advocates with us to go over that bill in detail, but if you want to wait one more month and we'll make sure to address it then, that's okay with you?
That would be great.
Okay,
thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. All right, let's move to section 4.2, legislative tracking. This is on page 69.
Can I ask a question about Kathy Martin?
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. I've been out talking to people, and first, I saw that you have this wonderful turf driving class, but it one of the parts of it says how to water your turf more efficiently or something. Is that what we really want to encourage?
No, I mean, I think.
I mean, I just could maybe look at the title of it.
Yeah. You know what was on? Was it on like Facebook or?
Yeah, it was on Facebook, and I think Laura sent it out, and it's Saturday.
I think I remember the same thing, Director Plovac, and I'm like, we should rephrase that. So let me follow up.
Because I said I would repost it on my social media, but I didn't title it. So I just think that that's not maybe good to be encouraging people to. And the other thing,
I have had also two other questions, and I don't know who to answer them, to ask them to you. The city had recently did a Wednesday ABC News segment where they have like something like Waterwise Wednesday or something on ABC News, and Heather Miranda interviewed someone with a rain barrel. And then I got all kinds of questions. Do we have a rain barrel program or is it only the city? We don't have one, right? It's only the city.
I believe you can get a rain barrel through one of our programs.
Oh, now,
but
good.
Let me.
Yeah, because if you can tell me about that, because this was a great thing. They had we had that little bit of rain when they came out and interviewed a resident and the rain was all going into the barrel. And then I had all these questions about rain barrels, and I didn't think the agency had.
Yeah, let me call it.
Okay.
For some reason, I'm thinking one of our programs adjusted to try and
have rain barrels. Okay, and then the last question is, as I've been walking around talking to people about drought or whatever, they have said, is there a program that would help financially to fill in your swimming pool or to get rid of your swimming pool? But this, after a while, if they get cracked or they become huge maintenance or the plumbing underneath goes out, it's quite expensive to get rid of them. And there's been some interest in that. And I think that would probably be as good a water-saving program as replacing turf. So I don't know if anybody's thought of that, but I thought I would pass it along.
Yeah, let me talk with our sustainability manager about that. I know my pool is in that condition right now. That was a big decision.
Yeah, right.
It is a decision. I mean, it's basically when you go to rehab a pool, is you're putting in a new pool.
Yeah.
And so it is a big decision.
Do you really want to do it?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I know a lot of people that have just taken them out and then they don't want to maintain them anymore and the water's getting expensive. And so this might be an opportunity.
Okay. Yeah, I've been checking, but
that's
a great idea.
Those are all my Kathy Martin questions, and she's not here, so I'm asking.
She's enjoying her concert.
Yeah.
So, all right. Let's move on to legislative tracking, which is page 69 on your board packet. Mr. Cole.
Yeah, I think, Dennis did a good summary tonight of kind of wrapping up the session here, right? Obviously, there's bills that we've been actively engaged in. Those have listed on the table. And as Dennis mentioned, by September 30th, we'll know kind of the results, the final results of many of them. We did have the one bill that already has been signed that we talked a lot about tonight. So.
Any questions from the public?
There is none.
Questions, comments from directors? None. All right, let's move to grant status report, page 71 of board packet. Mr. Cole.
Yeah, continue to pursue grant funding where it makes sense for the agency. So this table, I think, tries to do a good job of capturing kind of the history of our grant funding, as well as the grant fundings that we're pursuing, and then some that we pursued and not. Maybe got all the way home. So we did have a recent conversation. What we've been doing on the ones that we haven't been successful on is a lot of those have been with the Bureau of Reclamation. They offer a counseling after that, and we've been taking that opportunity on all those that have not been successful. And we have learned a lot of insight through that process. So it has already paid dividends. We did that with the meter replacement grant funding that we did. We didn't make it home on the first round. Mm-hmm. We had that debrief with them, adjusted our application for the next round, and we were successful on that one. So the most recent one, we just went through that process as well. It was, we had applied for Title 16 funding for our recycled water program. And so we got some really good feedback. We will be adjusting our application and submitting again in the next round. So really helpful to have that kind of continual learning improvement cycle on that. And so we have kind of a team that participates in that. And I think it, hopefully we'll start to pay dividends and already has on one of the large grants that we've received.
Any questions from the public?
There is none.
Okay. Questions come from directors?
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's Cheryl Fowler is definitely, as you guys know, is our lead on that. She does a tremendous job of hurting, you know, all of us. These grants are substantial efforts for the organization. They involve, you know, the Water Resources Department, but obviously operations is involved. Engineering is significantly involved. Finance is involved. So hurting all those people to kind of, you know, add those things on to the to-do list in the way that you're going about project procurement is a big deal. And it's working pretty darn well right now. So in a large part, thanks to Cheryl and the broader team for valuing the ability to go after grants.
Well, then thank you to Ms. Flowers.
Yeah.
Flowers.
Yeah, I'm definitely glad to hear that there's a post-application sort of counseling service where we can find out what we did wrong. That's pretty good. Glad we realized that. Okay, moving on to sponsorship tracking. Mr. Cole, page 75.
Nothing too much to add there, just normal tracking.
I just want to extend a huge thank you to Ms. Martin and her team for participating in the JCI adulting class. It was a big event. Saw a lot of students from Santa Clarita. Students also with their parents too. I think that was very productive. So big thanks for that. And also looking forward for CAS for Kids. Now, it is my understanding that Mr. Stone is going to be emceeing that event, or that I misheard that?
I'm not sure. Yeah, he could be. I know he's been heavily involved in that event in the past, so that could very well be the case. I just haven't heard that yet.
Okay. Now, going to these seminars and conferences, you hear that he's a huge fan of karaoke. We'd like to see that in action.
And I think he mentioned he actually performed at the last Urban Water Institute conference. Some lobby music, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions from the public? Directors, no questions. All right, moving to 4.5, committee buying calendar. Mr. Cole, page 77.
Yeah, nothing specific to point out, but just say from the committee's review.
Comments, questions from the public?
That's not.
Directors?
Nope.
On page 77, on October 20th, we're going to get the tour of agency's new website. Is that 100% or possibly?
I'm not going to say 100%, but I think we are on track to start unveiling the website. So that is definitely a Kathy Martin question.
Okay.
I haven't got the very latest as of, you know, just this last week. So
has she shared with you any visuals or any graphics for the billboards that she plans to purchase around Santa Clarita?
I have not been involved in that loop, but I can definitely track it down.
No worries. I'm sure once those are able to present it to us, it's curious. Okay, this leads to item 5, adjournment. Thank you for joining, and we'll see you in one next month.
Appreciate it.